Welcome, everyone. It's as promised, we're 45 minutes past the hour. So we're going to get going with our next session in here. If I could ask everyone to take a seat, then we can get going. Now, I'm on the floor for this because our speaker is going to be speaking from the floor here, so I thought for solidarity purposes, I would also be here from the floor. So, you know, the dictionary tells us that optimism is hopefulness and confidence about the future and for the successful outcome of something. That something, I think, for all of us here is higher education. So what are the resources, the ideas, and the assets we have at our disposal that will help us work toward a successful future for higher education? This is the subject of our next speaker's presentation. Mark David Milliron is the Chancellor of the Western Governors University, Texas. Prior to taking this position, he served as Deputy Director for Post-Secondary Improvement with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, leading efforts to increase student success in the U.S. post-secondary education sector. Now, Mark has received many recognitions for his leadership in teaching and learning. In 1999, the University of Texas at Austin's College of Education named Mark a distinguished graduate for his service in the education field. Then in 2005, he received the annual PBS ETS O'Banion Prize for transformational work in support of teaching and learning. And in 2007, the American Association of Community Colleges, or AACC, presented him with its National Leadership Award. And in 2011, the National University Technology Network named Mark the recipient of the Distinguished Service Award for his leadership in advancing innovative technology in education. In roles prior to his role at the Gates Foundation, he founded a private consulting group and served as an endowed fellow, senior lecturer, and director of the National Institute of Staff and Organizational Development in the College of Education at the University of Texas at Austin. Mark served as Vice President for Education and Medical Practice with SAS and was President and CEO of the League for Innovation. It is now my warm pleasure to welcome Mark Milliron. Thank you, Mark.
So what I hope we can do today in this intimate setting is actually dive into a conversation. You can probably turn the mic down a little bit. I don't know if our sound guy's back there at all, but it's loud. Dive into a conversation about this notion of an optimist education agenda and how we can leverage technology to tackle some of the big challenges. I don't know if some of you saw the piece I wrote a little over a year ago for the Chronicle of Higher Education. It was called Time to End the Family Feud. And it was about this notion of ending these conversations about to use or not to use technology and talking more about how we use all the arrows in our quiver to hit the mark. Really think about how we tackled some of these big challenges. And what I didn't really want to title that piece, Time to End the Family Feud. What I wanted to title it was Time to Put Technology on Purpose. And the whole idea was to really make it kind of go after the big challenges. The challenge for us right now is being optimistic about education is somewhat difficult if you look at some of the big data points that are out there. Having worked at the Gates Foundation for the last 2.5 years, the one data point that hit Bill and Melinda between the eyes and got them committed to investing literally billions into this problem of post-secondary college success. One of the data points that was probably the hardest to swallow is the idea that the intergenerational transmission of poverty has never been higher than it is right now in this country, which basically means you've never been more likely to die poor if you were born poor than right now in the United States. Does anybody else see that as a problem? Yeah, it's a real issue. And the challenge around that, if you look at some of the data, is thinking about how you disrupt that cycle. And it is true today that education is still the single biggest disruptor of that cycle. But it used to be a K-12 education was a disruptor of that cycle. That's not the case anymore. Now it actually is, and I'm going to use the long, convoluted phrase, a post-secondary credential with labor market value is what helps break that cycle of poverty. Notice I didn't say a degree for all. Because what we're talking about is a family of post-secondary credentials that carry some kind of labor market value, apprenticeship, certification, diploma, degrees of different shapes and sizes. And in some markets, a Cisco Network Academy certification carries more weight and economic possibility than an English degree does, right? I'm not comparing relative value. I'm just talking about breaking cycles of poverty. And for us, it's thinking about how education can be leveraged to help more people have access and success on those kinds of journeys. What we know is that we've drastically increased the pathways into higher education in this country. And one of the funniest conversations you get into are people who make the argument that American higher education doesn't change very much. And I keep thinking they must not have picked up a history book ever. Because if you look at the last 175, 200 years in American higher education, it's pretty radical in terms of the kind of change we've had when you take a long view of this. We invented land-grant institutions. We invented junior colleges, technical college, universal high school coming out of the Kalamazoo decision, community colleges out of the Truman Commission of the late 1940s. We had the rise of community colleges at one a week in the late 60s, early 1970s in this country with the second GI Bill that came out of the Vietnam War era. We had the rise of for-profit colleges like the University of Phoenix, which really was not an online college at all, right? It was a adult-focused, weekend, alternative delivery kind of focused institution. And we had the rise of things like early college high schools, which even 15 years ago, people wouldn't even get their minds around the idea of early college high schools as a concept for folks. So we have done innovation after innovation after innovation, and many of those innovations have been focused on, in fact, almost all of them have been focused on access to higher education. The challenge for us is people are getting in the door, but they're not necessarily getting across the stage. What the data show is only about half the people who start in American higher education actually finish. And that radically varies based on income. The folks in the top income, two income quartiles, are between 60 and 80% likely to finish their credential, varying based on certain demographic characteristics. The folks in the lower two income quartiles are only about 12% likely to finish, which varies based on, again, basic demographic. In fact, if you're first generation in those two lower income quartiles, you go down sometimes as low as 9% likely to finish your credential, which population group is growing. The upper two income quartiles or the lower two income quartiles. So the folks that we're having the biggest challenge with kind of educating are the ones that are that are expanding the most. And for us, what's clear is that the jobs are requiring more and more education. If you look at Cornell Valley studies out of Georgetown University, it's just pretty clear that more of the new jobs being created require some kind of post-secondary credential. You can argue about it all you want, but the data are there around this. And depending on the studies you read, McKinsey's Winning by Degree study talks about our capacity needing to add between, 750,000 to 2 million new credentials a year by 2025 if we really want to be able to keep up with the needs for our economy. The basic estimates are about 300,000 more credentials at least for us to keep up. The challenge for us is we've gone from first in the world in post-secondary credential attainment to 13th. And we're slated to have the first generation that is coming that is less educated than the one that came before. First time ever since we've been recording these kinds of data. Now, does this sound like an optimistic situation? Yeah. The challenge for us is this is pretty hard, but I would argue we have tackled the big challenges of our time with innovation after innovation in American education, and I think you're about to see us really go after this. And in some ways, I talk about trying to make Malthusian these arguments. Malthus made the argument we'd never have more than a billion people on the earth, and now how many do we have? About 7 billion people, right? Because he didn't really think about how new technology, new techniques, new behaviors would really kind of impact this. And I would argue the innovations that are coming our way are deeply tied to technology in many ways, but they are going to require us to focus on this notion of why people need education, and I'm going to argue there's some big whys, because I think for them it puts them on an educational pathway to possibility, it puts them on an economic pathway to possibility, it puts them on a social pathway to possibility, and it puts them on, in some ways, a personal efficacy pathway to possibility, a sense of agency and control of their own lives. We all get this, and we embrace it. But if we really want to help them on those pathways, we have to be willing to tackle some pretty, what I call, deeper learning conversations. And this is where you all come in. We need people like you who are schooled in the use of technology to improve learning to be willing to step back and engage some pretty important and deep learning conversations with folks. And the challenge is many of our technology conversations have turned into either hyperbole sessions or sales sessions, right? We're trying to sell people. People are trying to sell people on a technology, or they're full of hyperbole about how it's going to change everything. Have you ever sat through a session like that? Yeah. And I'm just going to, because I'm increasingly frustrated by this. I think for us, it has to be about our willingness to step back as leaders who care about the use of, who care about using education to impact people's lives, and we think technology might be able to have an impact, be willing to have some of these deeper learning conversations. Now, before we jump into these conversations, I want to talk about the way we approach that conversation. Some of you have been through this before with me, through this with me before, so bear with me. But if you haven't, it's worth doing. A friend of mine is a neuroscientist and has this great exercise to talk about the way we approach the dialogue. I need both of your hands free. So if you're holding a laptop or an iPad, you'll need to put that down for a second, or at least just make sure you balance it well on your knees. Okay, you'll need both your hands up. We're going to put your hands up like this. Okay. And on the count of three, we're going to clap them hard and leave them there. One, two, three. Rub them up and down. Clasp them together. Put them in your lap. Now look down at your hands. How many of you, by a show of hands, have your right thumbs on top? Your right thumb is on top. Raise your hand. Look around the room. Okay. How many of you have your left thumb on top? Raise your hand. Okay. Look around the room. Okay, hands back down. When the neuroscientists were studying this, they're studying something called autonomic functioning. It's when your brain goes on autopilot. You have core autonomic functions you have no control over, like if you sneeze, you'll close your eyes. Others are more rote, and they happen over time based on correlates, things that it's related to. Your brain likes to neurosynaptically wire things so it can go off to other things that they considers to be more important. You have all the way up to the basic autopilots, like you arrive at work after a 30-minute drive, and you don't remember a thing about the drive you just took, right? My favorite is you're naked, you get out of the shower, but you have no idea if you washed your hair or not, right? Okay. You have all these things stepping up. Now, this one is one that is correlated to something, and they were trying to find the correlate, whether you put your right thumb or your left thumb on top. What do you think they thought it was related to? First, they thought it was handedness, right? Whether you were right-handed or left-handed. You just saw the data. Is it related to that? No, in fact, there's no correlation to handedness, which kind of freaked them out. So they dove deeper into it, and what do you think the next theory they thought was? Right brain, left brain. They got trendy. They were sure it was right brain, left brain. They brought in the best experts on this. And after a lot of study on this, and they were sure this was it, it actually turned out it's pretty much not. There's a small correlation to it, but not enough to make them even close to convinced that it was related to right brain, left brain. So now they have, you know, they're really concerned about this, and so they're grad students. They have plenty of time on their hands. They go after this, and they start doing cluster analytics, where they start putting all the characteristics of the right thumbers together into a cluster, and then all the characteristics of the left thumbers into a cluster. And after doing everything from behavioral personality profiles, Myers-Briggs, all that kind of stuff, they have a great name for the right thumbers. Okay, the right thumbers in this room, they call you the sexy people. So you're the sexy ones. See some of you tweeting that out already. You get out to your networks, right? Okay. They have a great name for the left thumbers. The left thumbers, they call you the sneaky people. You're the sneaky ones. And now we'll see if we have any of the final group. The final group of people who put neither their left thumb nor their right thumb on top, they put their thumbs side by side. Did we get anybody who did that? Raise your hand if you're in that last group, if you're willing to raise your hand. It's about 1 to 100, so I'm surprised we didn't get one in here because it's relatively stable on this. By the way, the researchers say these are the people to watch if you see them. They're the ones who are sneaky about being sexy. Right? I want you to know. But let's go to the meat of this exercise. There's a reason for this exercise. Put your hands back up like this. We're going to do this again. Clap them together hard on the count of three and leave them there. One, two, three. Rub them up and down. Clasp them together. Now slowly bring your hands back in front of your face. Butterfly them out. Good. Slowly put them back together the other way with the other set of fingers interlaced and the other thumb on top. Squeeze it and put it down. How does it feel? Awkward, odd, strange. Somebody said sexy. I heard that. I want you to get this feeling for a second, because part of our challenge as people who care about education and care about how we're going to thoughtfully apply technology to education is the challenge of people who've put in 10, 20, 30, 40 years of their lives into this thing called education, and they have it wired. They know the way it's supposed to work. They know how it's supposed to feel. They know how it's supposed to just, in some ways, the ambiance of it makes sense to them. And when you start talking about some of these new technologies and new techniques, how does it feel to them? Right? Doesn't feel sexy. It makes them actually quite concerned. And I'm worried that many of our conversations devolve into, again, sales or hyperbole. And for us, it's realizing that people are deeply uncomfortable about these things, and we have to be willing to catalyze the conversation around it. I'm going to give you five. In my experience, these are five of the most important conversations to drive your work, and that can help us take on this challenge, this Optimist Education Agenda challenge, which is leveraging technology to help more people succeed. I think the first one is a brutal focus on learning at the center of everything we're trying to do, and learning being the driving proposition behind why we're using this technology in the first place, we're using new techniques in the first place. A lot of people give this lip service, but it takes a lot of work to make sure learning is at the center of this, and I'm just going to give you a couple of examples of this. One of the things we know, for example, is that in our country, if you look at the data, we are radically failing at meeting the needs of people who need developmental or remedial education. Are there anybody coming into your colleges that are underprepared for college-level work when they begin? Right? In fact, nationally, it's about 40%, and broader higher ed, about 70% if you're in access institutions. The students who are coming in typically experience something called a placement test. And a placement test tells you whether they're going to go into a remedial class or they're going to go straight in. The problem with this is what the data basically show is that if a low-income student is put into developmental education, it is figuratively the Bermuda Triangle of higher education. Okay? Most students go in and never come out of that developmental education experience ever to get a credential. And if there's ever been something we should have been focusing on the learning outcomes of, it's probably around developmental remedial education. And what people are trying to do now, the folks at the Community College Research Center in partnership with the Merit with Achieving the Dream and the Gates Foundation, the Lumina Foundation, and a host of others, is really tackle this issue of developmental education and put learning at the center of it. And what they're figuring out is innovations like, can you take students who are just below the cut score and mainstream them with supplemental instruction that is often delivered in an online format with virtual supports for that student? In other words, kind of a virtual scaffolding for that student, help them be more successful than if they go through a full sequence of developmental education and the results are in on that. Yeah, actually, they're much, much more likely to be successful provided that kind of virtual scaffolding. Or can we give them more diagnostic assessments that tell you, instead of saying that you're going to have to sit through a whole other set of courses, let's more deeply diagnose your learning challenge. And if there are 35 learning outcomes for that course, and there's only six that you don't know, instead of making you take the whole course again and hope that you're there the weeks of that 16 weeks you have to sit through the course, let's do accelerated modular developmental education to figure out how we can leverage technology to put you in front of the learning challenges you absolutely have with good digital resources and a tutor, and let you go as fast as you can go to remediate that problem. And the people who are doing this are using things like the math emporium model. They're using accelerated integrated basic education and skills training. And what we're finding is people can get through what used to take 16 weeks or a year, they can get through in a matter of weeks and months because they can accelerate it and leverage technology to be able to do it. Some of you are innovating with this in a big way, but the idea around this is not to just throw a course-based solution at every learning problem, but to innovate with the use of the technology and make learning be the center of the entire redesign. Our challenge right now is the tradition is getting in the way of learning. Because the big burning question for learning-centered education, it's not new, it's been around since the late 80s, early 1990s, it's this notion of, one, look at all of your policies, your programs, and your practices, and ask the first burning question, which is, does what you're doing improve or expand learning? Number one question, does it improve learning? And the second burning question is, how do you know? What are your data, quantitative and qualitative, that tell you that what you're doing is actually improving learning? And the problem is we have the war of anecdotes in most of our places where we tell the great story. And many of our programs are children of champions, and they're not really helping most people be successful. And if we were tackling things with that learning-centeredness, we'd be able to take things on in a much more aggressive way. I'll give you another example. I mean, things, if you look at Western Governors University as a model of this, what Western Governors University has done as an innovation, it is actually taking learning-centeredness and put it at scale in a big way. So what we tend to do is take a degree program, and we'll say, for example, if you're going to be an IT, get a bachelor's of IT in information assurance cybersecurity, we will then say we'll get a group of industry experts together with a group of academics who are top-notch in that field. We'll look at that degree pathway, and we'll break it down into what's called competency units. In other words, what are the learning outcomes we want for students? What should they know and be able to do after they get through with that bachelor's program? Once we've broken it down into those competency units, which, by the way, is the hardest part of this whole process I'm about to unpack, really getting agreement on what those learning outcomes are supposed to be. And we take a typical degree pathway, we'll be between 100 and 140 learning competency units. We then have another group that are specialists in digital curricular resources, and they'll go find the best digital curricular resources that help teach those learning competencies. And then we have another group that are specialists in assessment that put together the assessment portfolio that tells you a student has achieved those competencies. And by the way, it's a combination of quantitative and qualitative portfolio assessment, performance, and a whole host of other things. It's not just the written exams. And wherever possible, we use industry certifications that will ladder into credentials, which we'll talk about in a bit. Once that infrastructure is put in place, and it's all centered around the learning outcomes for that student, we then hire faculty, and the faculty are 100% full-time, and they serve as student mentors first. Their goal is to actually shepherd a group of students through a learning experience. And then, again, we hold learning constant, and we let time vary. Let me unpack what that means. When a student comes in, we assume two things, that students come in knowing different things, and we assume that they learn at different rates. Is that a safe assumption? Okay. I would argue many of our current traditional models of education assume neither of those things. We actually operate many times an industrial factory model on an agrarian calendar, meeting the needs of the information age. Most of the students could use something more flexible. So first thing we do is with the mentor and the student figure out what that student already knows. So based on their transcripts and based on the training they might have received in the military or in the workplace, we look at the competency units, and they have to demonstrate it. They think they're ready to pass 30% of those competencies because they've been a medic in the military for the last 3 years. They can actually sit for the assessments and show us that they know those things. But if they can document they know those things, they're done with that. And those learning, that's where they begin. That's their learning baseline. Then they begin with the faculty member, and in six-month chunks, they determine which learning outcomes make the most sense for them to learn next, and they take 10 to 15 learning outcomes, and they say, you're going to go after those during the next 6 months. And in six-month chunks, they're connected to the digital learning resources, and they meet with that mentor on a weekly basis or more, and they try to achieve as many of those as they can achieve. And again, it's all you can eat. They can go as fast as they can go, or they can slow way down when they hit math, because they all do when they hit math. Okay? But what is beautiful about this is because students, especially adult students who come with great experience, can begin from where they really need to begin, and then can accelerate based on when the work they're willing to put in as they put in this work, we see a typical bachelor student in greater higher ed takes about 60 months to finish a bachelor's degree. Our students take about 30 months. Typical master's student takes about 30 months. Our typical master's student takes 21 months. And we do very well with accreditation because we're very clear about what our learning outcomes are, and we're very clear about what our assessment systems are with this. It's a very learning-centered system. Do I think it's the right model for everybody? Absolutely not. The thing I love about it is the idea that it is focused on learning absolutely first. The learning is constant. Everything else can vary around it, but the idea is we want to know that student knows what they're supposed to know by the time they come out. And the whole idea is that student is then held to that standard as they're moving forward. Does that make sense? Different way of challenging it. Once you have learning at the center of it, the second major question is this notion of the learner focus. The notion of the learner focus is thinking about who we are actually serving as opposed to who we wish we were serving in some ways. And in many parts of higher education, we're still wrapped in that challenge of our kind of mythical idea of who is in higher education. Many of our policies are still focused on that kind of mythical student. What percentage of the students are living on campus going full-time and not working in this country? If you had to guess, in higher education, what percentage of the students living on campus going full-time, not working? It's less than 20% if you look at the data. The modal student is working and going full-time, which is quite hard. We have what's called a learn and earn society, and thinking about that is going to make us design programs differently and think about how we leverage technology differently. If you want to see something that will challenge you in this kind of idea, check out the website for Corporate Voices for Working Families. They have these great profiles of learn and earn partnerships where corporations or just large employers are partnering with education, and they're creating what's called a learn and earn sync. But what they're saying is, let's look at our policies at the employer level and look at our policies and practices at the college level and figure out how we can create a more learner, a working student-friendly pathway for these folks to be able to come through. So everything from at the college level saying, can we create blended and hybrid environments so that students can, and online environments, so that working students can be more successful? Most of you have probably innovated with that. even scheduling classes at midnight. There are many community colleges now that have midnight classes that are absolutely packed. And every time I say that in front of faculty groups, they tell me to shut up immediately. Don't talk about that, right? Okay? But there are lots of flexible options. That's just the flexibility side of it. On the employer side, there's the light sync things about being flexible with your scheduling and then tuition assistance and that. And then deep sync partnerships around apprenticeships and kind of dual training kinds of options. But if you want to see here something exciting, look at what UPS has done, for example. UPS was having challenges in Louisville with their big distribution center with their part-time employees. Their part-time employees were turning over at almost 400% clip, wiping them out in terms of hiring and training these kinds of folks. What they discovered was if they invested in those folks' education, and by the way, this is the important part, it had their education they were investing in at higher education level had nothing to do with UPS. It just had to do with enabling that student to become a good working learner. What they found out is by creating a tuition assistance program, flexible working hours, and encouraging them to go back to college, those people ended up staying on for the modal person about 2 years plus, as opposed to turning over, you know, over and over and over. And just by that savings and hiring and training, it more than paid for itself. Not to mention you had people who ended up being longer-term employees, who were better employees, who showed up and were more loyal for you. So the program completely paid for itself. The idea here is figuring out how you can be, in some ways, not be penny-wise and dollar-dumb, think about the kind of model that's going to pull that together. I love the notion, the folks at WCET, and I'm sure you've talked about it at this conference with the PAR project that came out of the Gates Foundation, the Predictive Analytics Reporting Framework. What they did is the largest federated data set of multiple institutions out there, analyzed the student mix, and one of the things they've discovered is that this, and this is pretty intuitive, there's kind of an e-harmony effect with our students and the institutions they go to. Okay? The right student with the right kind of institution, with the right kind of scheduling format, it actually works and it sings for them. But if the student tries to force themselves into an institutional fit that doesn't work, it's a real problem. And that's one of the reasons why I'm a big believer in when we're talking about higher education, talking about an ecosystem of providers. I think there are lots of different kinds of providers that need to provide different kinds of niches, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But thinking about that fit really matters. But the most important thing for us as institutional learning providers is we have got to get better at understanding who our learners actually are. Not thinking about who we wish we were teaching, but who are our actual learners and what are those profiles? I am stunned how many universities and colleges I go into and I ask them to tell me about their modal students. Give me five profiles of students who come to you and they can't break it down. They can't tell you a right from high school high ability student who has these kinds of needs, or a right from high school underprepared student who has these kinds of needs, a returning adult this age, and they can't break you down to their 5 to 7 core profiles. Once you do that, you could begin design your educational programs around the needs of those students. Is a right from high school underprepared student the same as a returning adult who's a displaced worker? No, their needs are different, and the problem is we end up trying to create these one-size-fits-all policies or technology outreach strategies when these are very different kinds of populations. The learners actually really matter. The second part of this thing is actually helping the learners themselves take responsibility for this. The closing chapter of this book, Elements of Successful Organizations, is a chapter called The Learn and Earn Baker's Dozen, which is a set of 13 strategies that are written directly to working learners that talk about how they can be more effective on this journey of working and learning. And one of the reasons I put this together is because we know all this kind of stuff, but we rarely just tell the students. We don't just say, these are the things we know will make you more successful. And by the way, three of them have to do with the use of technology, the importance of them actually learning how to harness technology to make themselves more successful as they're taking on that journey. Third conversation around learning is this notion of realizing not only if learning is at the center and the learner, we really care about the different learners that are coming our way, there are large conversations right now around the notion of learning credential pathways. And I want to talk about this for a second because the data are pretty interesting around this. What we know from momentum studies is that a student who gets a sub-baccalaureate credential is more likely to get the baccalaureate. So if a student gets a certification, they're more likely to get an associate's. If they get an associate's, they're more likely to get a bachelor's degree. In fact, our data at Western Governors says that if somebody comes in with an associate's degree, they're twice as likely to finish a bachelor's degree as anybody else. The challenge is many of our students are so aspirational, all they focus is the bachelor's degree, and they don't curate the sub-credentials along the way. And the problem is if you're a low-income earner, if you're a low-income student coming in, that typically is a long journey for a bachelor's degree. In fact, Hispanics in Texas here, Hispanic male in Texas on a bachelor's degree journey takes between 6 to 8 years to get their bachelor's degree. Lots of reasons for it. A lot of them they won't take student loans. They're very debt-conscious kind of culture. A bunch of other reasons for it. But that's a long time. And what's the number one reason people are dropping out? It's a little thing called life happens. And life happens is kids get sick, lose your job, car breaks down. And if you're on a learning journey and one of those things happen and you don't have a credential to backstop you, like a certification or an associate's degree, it's much less likely you will be able to get a life-sustaining job that will be able to keep you out of poverty, and you'll end up in a cycle where it's very hard to get back into higher education. So it is very smart for us, if we're thinking about low-income learners, which is the biggest growing population in our society, if we want them to be successful. There are now states out there that are looking at all their universities and saying, can you look at all your degree pathways, and either in partnership with your community colleges or by yourself, can you create a pathway of credentials for people where they can get certifications that lead to an associate's degree, that lead to a bachelor's degree? Does that make sense? It's a lot easier said than done. It's one of the things you have to sit down with your curriculum committees and really, because it's a very smart strategy. Because one, you give that student momentum towards the next credential. And two, if they do have to drop out, one, you've already achieved some kind of completion metric around it. And two, that person has a poverty-breaking credential that allows them to be able to come back in more successfully if they're going to come in. It's just reality therapy about the folks that are coming into our mix. And there are all kinds of interesting examples. One of the best ones from this state is El Paso Community College, in partnership with UT El Paso, have a partnership where somebody transfers from the community college into the university after 40 hours, say. After they've achieved another 20 hours and gotten 60 hours, and it maps back to an associate's degree at the community college, they will send the credits back without the students. They'll just send it back to the community college and say, here are the credits that will give that person up to an associate's degree. And they'll send a letter to the student and say, oh, by the way, you've achieved your associate's degree. If you want to go pick it up, it's ready at the community college next door. Okay? And it's called reverse transfer. And the idea here is just force the issue of having them get credentials along the way. A good example of Western Governors University is in, for example, our IT pathway. If a student is on a Bachelor's of Science in Information Technology degree program with us, they will achieve anywhere from 3 to 6 industry certifications before they get their bachelor's degree, because we use those certifications as part of our competency outcomes. But the great thing for our students is many of them find out those certifications are as valuable as their bachelor's degree when they actually get to the other side. But it's about curating those credentials up. But we've got to think about how we can map that in. Now, it's getting more interesting now because you have things like the whole notion of digital learning badges that are coming out there, where they're saying, let's go down to the competency level and start giving digital badges for these folks' competencies. And then how do you roadmap those into degree programs? So you're going to have badges going into certifications, going into associate's degrees, going into bachelor's degrees. It's about to get pretty interesting. We're going to have to go back and really think about how these badges map into our different credential pathways. But many people are going to be innovating against this. And it's going to be even more pushed even more fully by folks like, I'm sure you've been reading DIYU, Do It Yourself University, Anya Komenets. In fact, she has a new book out called An Edupunk's Guide to Getting a Credential, all about this notion with 2 million courses on the internet and the cavalcade of free open digital resources out there. You have edupunks who are able to go get the learning wherever they want to get the learning, and they just want to come to you for credentialing. Right? They've already done the learning on their own, and now they just want to come and get some kind of credential because they want to say, I already know this stuff. Give me whatever test you want to give me, and I can show you I can do it. In fact, the accrediting agencies right now are wrestling with this issue because sooner or later, they're going to be asked to accredit learning, not institutions, because if people are going to go on their own learning pathways. And by the way, this is happening in the continuing education world in a big way. Anybody who's into music education or whatever else, people are doing a whole host of their own learning on their own, leveraging these kinds of digital badges, these kinds of different credential pathways. Now, you notice I didn't talk about technology in specific until now, because I think there is a lot to kind of create the foundation of this conversation. And the foundation of the conversation is around learning and learners and the notion of what kind of credentials are going to give them the path out of poverty. Once you've done that, you can begin to think about the technology that can get you there. Some of the ones that probably excite me the most, and I'll just touch on them briefly, are the ideas of, I'm a big fan of what's happening with blended learning right now. where people are using, like Carnegie Mellon's Open Learning Initiative, using human learning science to tune the blended learning experience. And the idea is to figure out how to use technology to make the human moments precious. How can we make sure that the mix of how we use technology and human interventions actually makes the human moments precious? At Western Governors University, we basically are the flip model. We use digital learning resources to engage the student on those learning pathways, and then our students, our faculty, are mentors one-on-one with that student to synthesize, analyze, discuss, and to model the learning with that student. The idea is that they can engage the digital lecture somewhere else. They can work with our folks in a one-on-one model. And you've seen everything from Khan Academy to the others, where now people are being asked to do the digital lecture as homework, and they're asked to be doing the homework as classwork, right? And the idea is, again, figuring out how you make that face-to-face time much more important. By the way, this is nothing new. McKeachy was talking about this and the notions of great teaching, the more active classroom. The idea here is figuring out how we make those face-to-face moments with teachers absolutely mean something powerful for these folks, and make sure we use technology to displace what can be done well by other folks. Not to mention, really leverage really smart people in other places that can add value to our own instructional experiences. It's pretty nice to have Walter Lewin lecturing on physics for your students, right? Because they can bring in that kind of expertise and pull that in. Then, on top of that, the notion of curricular resource strategy, which I like a lot. And the curricular resource strategy is the emerging discipline, and I think we're getting better and better at this conversation. And remember we talked about with Western Governors, we get very clear about our learning competency units, and then we go curate digital resources that help you achieve those things. That's more and more the core conversation in higher education, is how do you curate the digital learning resources to get there? And I really think it's this combination of build, buy, share. And the build, buy, share is how do you build curricular resources that make the most sense for you to build? How do you buy the really good stuff from publishers that it makes sense to buy if it's digital and modular and hangs together well? And then how do you find the best stuff from the open courseware that actually makes sense for your learning experience? What I hear from students, however, is the challenge of this is making this stuff hang together in a way where it doesn't feel like the junk drawer, right? It actually feels like it's some kind of coherent through line between these digital resources, and it's a great experience for them to be able to navigate it, and it's not a harrowing experience to be able to navigate it. Is that your experience as well? Okay. The challenge for us is figuring out how to pull that together into some kind of a coherent strategy. Now, on top of all this is the kind of really in fun stuff with the games and the intervention and the kind of innovations that are happening. And I just want to use the demo from the Kinetic, the Kinect system, to talk about this for a second, because I want to use it as a standpost for this conversation. So many of you have seen the Kinect system. The Kinect system uses your body and facial recognition as the controller. I'm going to use two examples real quickly.
Your tires are toast. Go to the pits.
All right, I'm going in.
Okay, I'm ready.
Now, my friends who are in the NASCAR tell me that is way too slow. There's no way that person's going to win. The other example I think is more interesting. This one involves avatar video conferencing, massive database mining, and shopping.
Okay, for Sarah.
Hey, so did you get a dress for the party yet?
No.
Oh my gosh, it's in a week. Here, you have to see the one I found for you. That's the one.
I love it.
You should get it.
So their biggest problem with that system is the average person makes their avatar 15% skinnier than they actually are. Causes sizing issues, right? But I want you to think about this for a second. I remember being at technology conferences in the late 1990s, mid to late 1990s, where the conversations were about the coming power of GPS systems, how we were going to have these GPS satellites all around the globe connected to our cars, connected to personal devices. In fact, we're going to be able to drive a car and see a map of where we were going. In fact, if we put in an address, it would tell us where to go. It would tell us to make U-turns and go around. And we were putting on these conferences, by the way, and then after the event, it was a fantastic keynote with all this kind of cutting-edge stuff about what was coming, and after the keynote, we had these powerful, powerful feedback pieces from people in the audience that said, this is amazing, it's fantastic stuff, but it's so radically unrealistic, please don't ever talk about this again. How many of you have used a GPS system in the last year? Right? In fact, you're using it right now to figure out where you're going to dinner, right? The interesting thing around this is we have more interesting technology and techniques coming our way to improve learning than ever before. I am deeply worried that people get wowed by the bells and whistles and they don't anchor it in learning about whether or not it improves learning, which is why the analytics piece of this really matters. The ability to do work to actually understand the final impact of this and determine whether or not it is reaching, it actually improves learning with the learners we have and puts them on a completion pathway is the big bang for the buck. And for me, that's where analytics come in. And this really means gathering and storing the information. Our problem is most of our analytics initiatives are way too slow, and they're off target. So what do I mean by that? How many of you shop at Amazon? What happens at Amazon while you're buying a book? Right? People like you who bought this book also bought this, this, and this, right? It's a big data analytics run. It's a data mining run about people like you, a predictive model that is run for you based on your previous shopping things. And how long does it take them to get that recommendation to you, like a week or a month or a... No, it runs in under a second. It's only taking longer because of your bandwidth, right? How about our initiatives with data? What's our velocity like? We get interested in student retention or dropouts, and we get a group together to analyze what's happening with retention and dropouts in our own college. And they go collect the data, and they come back in, and the first thing they do is they argue about the quality of the data. Then they go back out and collect some more information, and they come back, and there's another argument about the quality of the data, but they go finally collect this last piece. Now it's time to bring in the faculty. You bring in the faculty, they're mad they weren't included from the beginning, you have to start over. You start over, go collect some more information, you bring that back in, and then you actually get a look at the data. The data are pretty dangerous, saying that there's some real problems at your college. You bring that up to the administration. The administration's really worried how that's going to look politically, so they want you to get some comparative data from other colleges that'll tell you where you fit in the larger mix. You go collect some other information from other colleges, it takes you tons of time to get the permissions from them to be able to get their data and pull that back in, do the comparative analysis. You do the comparative analysis and bring it up and you say, okay, we're kind of middle of the pack. It's not that dangerous. So now we'll go ahead and bring it to the board. You have to get on the board calendar. You get on the board calendar, present the information to the board. The board doesn't know what you're talking about. It takes you two or three sessions to really help them understand it. They then give you the ability. They say, what are you going to do about it? Your decision is to hire somebody to lead your retention initiative. So now you have to do a national search. You do a national search and it takes you about, what, 6 months to hire somebody? That person comes in and their first recommendation is to do what? Buy software. So you have to buy some software to tackle those problems, so you have to do an RFP. You do an RFP, you put that out there, and after 6 months of choosing the right company to come in to lead this initiative, that person, we finally hire that company, and after two lawsuits, you sign the contract, and then the person's first recommendation is to hire consultants to implement the software to help you drive the change at your institution. What has happened to the students about whom you collected the data? Yeah, their kids have enrolled at your institution, right? And I just mean, we've got to be serious about this, folks. Let's just be kind. It takes us at least a year before we harvest the students' data and give it back to them in a way that'll actually help them on their journey if we're lucky. Somewhere between 1 second and a year is some kind of balancing point for us. We have got to get faster with this, and we have got to get more on focus. The problem is we're putting our data, we are so focused on getting data to administrators and presidents and boards and legislators that we're missing the real point. The power of data, and this is my classic line, we have to build the right infrastructure to get the right data to the right people in the right way, and then powerful things can happen. Walk with me on the right journey again, right? The right infrastructure to get the right data to the right people in the right way, and then good things could happen. What do I mean by that? People at Ford, for example, discovered that they were having problems with their hybrid cars. People were getting mad because they weren't getting the mileage they were supposed to get out of their cars. And when they did the analysis, they discovered the reason they weren't getting the mileage is because they were driving the car incorrectly. And so they said, well, let's put together a little list. They put together the top 10 things people were doing wrong in driving the car, and they sent that to their customers. How happy were they with that? That didn't go over really well. So a 23-year-old engineer, with the help of a company called IDEO, came up with this idea of kind of a gamification of using the data to interact with the customer and give them information that would help them drive their car more effectively. If you look on the right-hand side of the dashboard, what you see is this, you see the whole plant. And the plant, what it basically does, if you drive the car correctly, the plant begins to grow. The leaves come out, the flowers bloom. If you drive the car incorrectly, the plant begins to wither, the flowers close, the leaves turn brown, and it begins to die. Okay? And the fascinating thing about this is it fixed the problem. Because people want to keep their plant alive. Right? I was talking about this the other day, and somebody said, yeah, their mom has this kind of car, and she's like, I'm going green, keeping the car green. But the idea is they were interacting with it. I actually think the power of data in education is going to be powerful for us when we do the kind of things that John Campbell does with the Signals Project, which I'm sure you've heard about. The idea of getting data right to the students to tell a student if they're on track or off track, right? The idea of saying, just a simple idea of something with the Signals Project that says, let's run a predictive model on what they're doing in that course and tell them, students like you who did the kind of thing you're doing, yellow light, did okay. Here's some things you might want to think about. Students like you who did the kind of things you're doing, green light, keep doing it, great stuff. People who did the kind of things you're doing, red light, stop now, talk to somebody. In fact, that is more useful use of data than trying to get it to administrators and to legislators. If you look at the medical world and you look at the consumer world, what they figured out is the power of data is unleashed when you get it to the front lines. When teachers and learners can actually interact with the data, some really powerful things can happen. And I think we're going to start seeing an ecosystem of apps that get data to learners and to teachers that are going to take our data initiatives to the whole next level. I'm working with a group called Civitas Learning that is driving this whole notion of an ecosystem of apps, the idea of pulling our data together and getting people like you to design applications that can be used, that people can actually do against this. Because I think the power of this is going to, again, getting the data in the hands of learners. Why is this important? If you've read any of the studies on academic tenacity, what it basically shows you is just kind of two really big things. One is students who are more tenacious are more successful, especially if they have a growth mindset. In other words, they think that if they work hard, they can grow and get better as a learner. That growth mindset's a big deal. If they have a fixed mindset, I'm smart or I'm dumb, it's a problem. Because if they think they're dumb, if they ever do something well, they self-sabotage. And if they think they're smart, if they ever get negative feedback, they think you're screwed up or they quit so they don't lose the game. Ever experienced a learner like that? They've been told they're special and they're brilliant, and the minute you tell them something negative, they quit because they're not used to getting the feedback. A growth-minded learner says, I have a lot to learn, and if I work hard, I can get better. The most important part, though, is that growth-minded learner has to have the ability to self-regulate, to know when they're on track or off track. And our challenge is we're not giving them enough data to self-regulate. The idea is getting data so they can know when they're on course or off course within the instructional experience. That's when it's going to get powerful. Now, on the basis of developing learning-centered, learner-focused, credential pathways, leveraging the right kind of technology, we are going to have the ability to enable our existing models and then to stand up brand new models of education that can tackle the challenges that we're facing right now in terms of college completion and success. I'm going to argue, if you read the paper on disrupting college, what I'm worried about is people want to talk about the disruptive institutions and the sustaining institutions, like one is heaven and one is hell. And what I think is going on right now is the rise of an ecosystem that can tackle this challenge. I think we're going to have more robust traditional universities. We're going to have more robust R1s, research and regional universities. We're going to have stronger community colleges. And we're going to have some new model universities like Western Governors and some of the for-profits that are out there. And we have to be willing to change our conversation. We have too many people that have nothing but a better than conversation. They're looking for the one best way to do higher ed. The truth is we are going to be better off with a better with conversation. We are better with robust research universities, regional universities, strong community colleges, and alternative learning providers doing what they do best. People trying to pretend to be what they're not is going to be a problem. We are still going to have people in our midst that want to have an on-ground, on-campus liberal arts experience. That's fine. Let them do that, and let them do that really well. And then we want to have other providers that are doing what they do well. And we have to be willing to hold in our minds that multiple models will let us be effective and figure out the technology for that. But that's a different kind of conversation. And our conversations too often devolve into better than conversations as opposed to better with conversations and figuring out how we tune with that in a pretty big way. Final set of ideas. We often talk about the power of core learning for our students. We talk about the power of critical learning and creative learning and social learning and the notion of courageous learning, which is the ability to continue learning for a lifetime. Critical learning and creative learning are talked about again and again in the deeper learning projects from Hewlett Foundation and a host of others. Whether you're talking about the Greater Expectations Project and others, we all know how important that is. Social learning, more important than ever before. It is still the number one way people get jobs. After they get our credentials, the number one way somebody gets a job is how? It is a social network. It is people that they know that help them get that job. What's the number one reason people are fired in this country? Take out economic downturn. Why are most people terminated from positions? Is it because of inability to do their job well? It's because of interpersonal conflict. Number one reason. In fact, the Sherm folks have a joke for it. They call it the jerk effect. Either you're fired because you are a jerk or you're fired by a jerk. But there's always a jerk involved in the situation somewhere, right? The social skills still really matter. People skills still really matter. The ability to engage. And the notion of courageous learning, the ability to learn for a lifetime. I love this quote from Eric Hoffer. He says, in times of drastic change, it is the learners who inherit the future. The learned are usually equipped to live in a world that no longer exists. We are training students for jobs that might not necessarily exist yet, right? And their ability to learn how to learn is really going to matter. What I think is interesting about this list of critical, creative, social, and courageous learning that everybody shakes their head up and down on is that what we hear from students is it would be great for them to actually see this modeled in our discussions about our own education systems. Can we be critically reflective about what's working and what's not? Can we be creative about the solutions? Can we get along as we have these conversations? And can we have the courage to actually do something about it? And for us, it's figuring out, can we bring that kind of spirit into our world and think about a big challenge? And the big challenge for us is to help more people get across the stage and be successful. Now, we're going to be short on time. I've got one thing I want to finish with, but I do want to see if we have any questions from the online folks. So I'll go ahead and let us know if we have anybody on there.
There's one.
Okay.
And this is around the Clayton Christensen thesis. So Clayton Christensen, in his writings on innovation, distinguishes between sustaining innovation and disruptive innovation. He also suggests that disruptive innovation cannot come from inside or from the current mindset. I think you touched on this a little. What kind of innovation would you say is needed if higher education is to meet its challenges? So could you elaborate on your idea of with versus in or out?
Yeah. So I think the challenge for us in kind of figuring out the family of solutions we're going to need to tackle these challenges is the ability to look for the innovative spark in wholly new institutions, but also to figure out how we support the intrapreneurs within more traditional universities and community colleges, which is sometimes more difficult. It's pretty hard to lead change from the inside in some of the more traditionals. Part of what we have to do is understand that you have to create some space for that disruption to happen and figure out how it can be valued as part of the learning enterprise. I actually think the trick to that is you have to let learning be at the core of your conversations. The folks that have really done this well have said learning is what matters most, and whether you're a university or a community college, the colleges that say learning is at the core of what we do, and we're going to take a look at that in the first, whether you're talking about Antioch or you're talking about Valencia Community College, the people who do that and hold learning at the center are more willing to be able, are more able to take on that kind of conversation. Anybody out here with a question?
I really enjoyed the talk. I just wanted to make sure I'm sure you know, but in terms of learning analytics, there are systems now that immediately look at and model the student and respond to. The intelligent tutor is what it's called. And in the field, there's a whole field called education data mining. And for instance, Carnegie Mellon has something called data store, so they keep that. Okay, but my question is, if you were to advise funding agents, say NSF or Gates or Hewlett-Packard, about a learning-centered mannerisms, and you're going to be talking about colleges that do not focus on learning, I mean community colleges that are set in their old ways, what do you think is an actionable item that you could propose that these groups would fund to get us, you know, get, say, people in this room to activate projects in these colleges that become learning-centered and learning-focused?
Yeah, it's a great question about where do you start and how do you get people to think about learning first. I think one of the most powerful things people could do in a more traditional college or university, and I love this notion of lost momentum analysis, is getting a college to take a step back and figure out, in the medical world they call it triage, right? If you figure out where you're really bleeding from in a big way, and if your college really steps back and says, where are we hemorrhaging student success? And what most people will figure out, if you're an access institution, it's going to be your developmental education or remedial education programs, or it's going to be in gateway courses that are wiping people out. And I would argue it becomes a Manhattan Project for that college right away to unpack those data and to figure out what innovations that they're doing now that could have drive momentum, or can they embrace what's called the CASE method, and CASE stands for copy and steal everything, right? Somebody else is doing it well, pull it in whatever way possible. And I'll just give you an example. There are some colleges that have said, we're going to take the three courses that are wiping out the most students, and we're going to put a SWAT team of our best faculty member with our faculty members, with our best librarians, with some strategic help, and they're going to go find the best curricular resources. They're going to get clear on the learning outcomes, the best curricular resources for that course, and they're going to create a master playlist that everyone can then use as a baseline. And then we're going to collect data to determine which of those curricular resources actually achieve the learning outcomes we're talking about, and create a CQI process to continually improve it. So everything from what Carol Twigg and a host of others have done into some homegrown kinds of efforts. I would argue beginning with the big, fat, hairy problems first and trying to solve something like a DevEd problem or like a gateway course problem is something that people can rally around. The other reason why it kind of works is because a lot of people aren't touched by those programs, and it, in some ways it has the biggest painful spot for the university, but at the same time, some of the people that will cause your biggest problems isn't going to raise their hackles right away because it's not going to change how they're doing anything yet. But you can show powerful results in those programs right away and actually help a whole lot of students. Okay. And it relates with this kind of... You're welcome. It relates to this final idea I bring you on this. If you're going to tackle these kinds of questions, and I encourage you, boy, I think we need you to be jumping into these conversations. And again, it's not about the hyperbole or about this. It really is about the learning-centeredness of this whole thing. I'm going to encourage you to buckle up and have some courage, because you are going to face two groups that are going to be significantly challenging. And I think you've got, one, have the patience to deal with the people who are a bit uncomfortable with this, right? And a lot of people are going to be uncomfortable with it because it'll be different, but they're not the ones you have to worry about the most. The ones you have to worry about the most are the extremes. People who are in one group that I like to call caustic cynics, who are angry about everything. It doesn't matter what you're talking about. You bring manna from heaven, it's too salty for them, and they're mad, right? A friend of mine calls them cave people. Cave stands for colleagues against virtually everything. Now, how many of you know a cave person somewhere in your world? Raise your hand, right? Now, if you don't know someone who's a cave person, you might be. I should think about that for a second. Now, they're only equaled, and they are equaled, by the people who are the true believers. The true believers will overpromise and underdeliver, and they're going to cut the credibility out of your initiatives. They will tell you that online learning is for everybody. Western Governors University model is the best thing there is in education. Whatever they're into, everybody should be into, or else you're Satan, right? And the problem is too many of our conversations end up with those two extremes being loud and proud and going at it. And other people walk up to that conversation and go, going back to work, right? Because they don't want to deal with it. Because, and I'll be blunt, many of those people are bullies. And they tend to own the conversation. We have to be willing to step into this mix, calm down the caustic cynics, temper the true believers, and create a reasonable space. Why I think some of the analytics initiatives you were talking about that are becoming to rise is because finally some people have said, no, let's get tough-minded about what really does improve learning with online. One of the things I love about Carnegie Mellon, one of the things I love about some of the learning agent stuff, even the Acuitas stuff that's coming out, is I think people have been willing now to jump into that conversation and to look at the good, bad, and the ugly. And I think people are getting beyond the hyperbole of the positive and the dire straits of the negative, and they're saying, let's really wrestle with how we make this work. And they're understanding that technology as a tool can be effective. It's not the end all. It's not the be all end all. There are deep personal human connections really matter in this thing called education. But it means you have to have the courage to step into the mix and have the conversation. Let learning lead the way and have it for a deeper purpose. Let me tell you, folks, The deeper purpose is the education, the notion of education as a pathway to possibility. It is the pathway to education possibility, economic possibility, social possibility, and personal possibility for our students. It is worth every bit of effort we can give. Thanks, folks.
Thank you, Mark. We're now on break for 15 minutes. We'll reconvene on the hour. Thank you.